Design.
Analysis.
Performance.
Books.
Sound.
Here on RN.
Hello, Robbie Buck joining you for Life Matters this morning. Hope you're well. Coming up, a discussion on what's been described as one of the country's best-kept secrets, low sex drive in men. Sexologist and researcher Elaine George suggests that far more men than previously thought are living with low sex drives. And in some cases, it's only increasing tension within their relationships. The cause, quite often, comes down to too much stress, and we'll talk about that. And then later on, we'll tackle another modern dilemma, this time how to broach the subject of body odour with a friend. All that on the way here on Life Matters. But first, hospital emergency departments are the front line when someone with a mental illness is having a serious episode, threatening suicide or violence. But do we let too many people reach crisis point before we respond? This is the conclusion of a survey conducted by the mental health charity SANE, which found that poorly managed mental illness drives repeat admissions to already stretched hospital emergency departments. A quarter of the respondents to the online survey had called 000 on 10 occasions, and one in five were discharged from hospital without a crisis plan to help manage the aftermath of an emergency admission. From the survey, SANE argues that mental health is a crisis-driven system, with emergency services and hospital emergency departments left to paper over the cracks. To discuss these findings, I'm joined by the CEO of SANE, Jack Heath, Pat Sutton, the mother of two sons with schizophrenia, who's also a member of the National Mental Health Consumer and Carer Forum, and Associate Professor Steve Elsom, the Director of the Centre for Psychiatric Nursing at the University of Melbourne. Welcome to all of you, and thanks for joining us for Life Matters this morning. Jack, can I start with you? You say the mental health system shouldn't be crisis-driven, but isn't it the nature of serious mental illness, bipolar, schizophrenia, depression, that it tends to manifest as a crisis?
That's a fair call. The issue that we've found here in the survey of over 600 people, though, was that people are having to go back to emergency departments time and time again. And when they do, we're finding a number of things are happening. One is the overwhelming majority, 80% of them, are not being given a crisis plan when they exit the hospital. And also there's quite significant waiting times when they get there. So I think your point's fair. Yes, we are expecting that there will be emergencies, but a lot of the time when the police, for example, are coming, and that will be on about half the calls that they're getting, certainly in Victoria, there's not the support there for the families and friends who are affected by the person with the mental illness.
Tell us a little bit about the survey itself. The they were self-selecting, I take it. It was anonymous. It was online.
That's right. Yes, this is a survey that was conducted from November last year to January of this year, and we make the surveys anonymous, of course, and what we found there was predominantly the respondents were about almost 75% were women who were ringing up concerned about family members, and also too in terms of the issues that people were wanting, were asking about in terms of their own situation, about a quarter with depression, about 18% bipolar, similar numbers for schizophrenia, slightly lower for anxiety, and then also personality disorders as well. And so the idea was trying to find out from these people what was their experience when they were interacting with the emergency services.
Did the survey ask who is most likely to make an emergency call? Do you get a sense of who's picking up the phone in the first place?
Yeah, so what is it? It's usually it's family members who are worried about one of their family that's obviously going to be at risk of either harming themselves or at risk of suicide, and that was about 72% of the people calling in.
Steve, can I bring you in at this stage? Can you give us an idea of the triage process in an emergency department when it comes to these sorts of episodes? How do you choose who gets dealt with first?
Okay, well, when someone presents to the emergency department, doesn't matter what their what the presenting problem is, they're assessed initially by the triage nurse, who's in most cases not a mental health specialist. They're there to deal with whatever comes through the front door of the emergency department, whether it's a mental health presentation or any other presentation. And they use a system supported by the Australasian Triage Scale, which is basically a system of deciding about the urgency in terms of need for treatment. So, for example, someone comes in and their heart's not beating, that's obviously emergency resuscitation, so it's a Category 1. We recently did some research at a Victorian regional hospital looking at what was actually happening in the triage in the emergency department for mental health presentations. It was a service that takes roughly 50,000 people per year, and of those, it was about 1,700 in our sample had a mental health-related chief complaint. And what we found in that particular study is that the majority, something just over 80%, were being triaged at categories 3 or 4. So basically that's saying they're moderate to low urgency. So they're being seen, well, that category of urgency requires that they're seen if it's category 3 within 30 minutes, category 4 within an hour. So that's the sort of level of urgency that is being done by triage nurses at that particular hospital that we're looking at. Now, in most emergency departments around Victoria and to a varying degree around the rest of the country, emergency departments are supported by specialist mental health services, and that can take a number of forms. For example, in many services, we have what's called the enhanced or extended crisis assessment and treatment team. So that's the crisis team that works with the public mental health service and typically goes out responding to crises in the community.
They will also service
the emergency department, so the triage nurse may identify it as a mental health problem and immediately refer to the mental health specialist based in the emergency department.
So would the majority of people who are in the emergency departments making those calls, would they have some level of mental health training in dealing with those cases?
Again, it will vary from hospital to hospital. Certainly the hospital that we were working with has a long history of providing professional development for their general triage staff around dealing with mental health problems. And part of our study wasn't actually an observational study, and we did find that the triage nurses were in fact very good at identifying mental health problems and then referring on to the specialist mental health service that was servicing that emergency department.
Jack, from your survey and also your own investigations, what has been your understanding of that process? Has it been effective?
Well, look, I think it varies from hospital to hospital. I mean, obviously, the situation Stephen was describing was there relating to one particular hospital. I think the issue here for us that's really important is that, one, there'll be sort of, they're pretty stretched resources anyway in the emergency department, so there's not criticisms being directed at the work that's being done by individuals in terms of workload, but we think that there's a need for more training, because when you're getting people who are going back again and again, to us this is the issue, is about these people are not getting adequate treatment, not so much in terms of necessarily when they're presenting at emergency, but in terms of the day-to-day management of their illness. Because if you've got someone that's got a severe mental illness and you're having to go back, as a number of the people here, sort of time after time, then to us there's an issue there in terms of the effective treatment of those individuals.
Is the policy universal across the country in these areas?
Well, in terms of the guidelines have been developed, which are there, which are operating nationally, but then the application within each state or within each particular hospital is going to vary.
You'd like to see it taken one step further, and you actually call on the back of this paper for actual separate spaces within emergency rooms. Is that a feasible call, do you think?
Well, I think that was one of the things that we suggested, that would be an ideal arrangement. Obviously, you've got to make decisions about resources. For us, the issue is just making sure that people are getting help in a very timely fashion once they get to emergency. But for us, there's a bigger picture sort of stepping back from that, is that we're not wanting people to be having to chase emergency so often.
Well, we'll get to that in a moment, because obviously preventative medicine can sometimes save you a lot of money over the long term compared to crisis management. But at this stage, can I bring Pat into the conversation? You've got two sons who are living with schizophrenia and have had many hospital admissions. How do you find their engagement in emergency in the ER rooms? And the suggestion of a separate space for mental health triage, for example, how would that be received?
I really do strongly believe in that kind of a system. And in South Australia, we did used to have that kind of a system, but there was a separate place at a major psychiatric hospital where people went through admission processes and then got allocated to the various hospitals. But because there was a desire to mainstream mental health, to reduce stigma, they thought that changing it to emergency department entry would be better. But it seems to me that it's backfired, because I mean, one of the major things about people with mental illness, high proportion don't think they even have a mental illness, let alone want to be in hospital. So there's extensive use of security guards in hospitals looking out for those people, not because they're violent or even that they're expressing suicidal ideation, but because they don't want to be there. They'd much rather, and they'd walk away if given the opportunity. Whereas people with mental illness who are extremely stressed, especially who don't want to be there and may be psychotic, need people with the skills, the skills that are required to be able to manage without just putting them in a separate area and having security guards them 24 hours a day. And this is an extremely more expensive way of caring for people in hospitals. It seems to me that the biggest issue is that the people with, and I think this is across the country, but it's particularly bad, I think, in South Australia too, is that the community supports aren't sufficient to keep people well in the community. And I mean, the survey saying that so many people wanted to get help before the crisis developed really acknowledges this need, and certainly that's the case with my son. One of my sons has avoided hospital almost totally in the last 20-year period, which is the same period for both of them, because he had early treatment. And that early treatment, the whole principle of early intervention, espoused by our wonderful Pat McGorry, is a fantastic thing, but that whole attitude, that way of treating people needs to be extended so that relapses are prevented in the community. And this requires basic things like a decent place to live, proper accommodation that's properly supervised and monitored, their physical and mental health needs are monitored, where they've got meaningful activities, where they don't spend all day smoking and possibly getting into trouble where they end up in hospital.
All right, well, they're good points. And Jack, can I come back to you on the back of what Pat has just said there? Obviously, resources are finite, and choosing where you spend the money is often difficult. But in an ideal world, where would you like to see the money being spent, and what kind of effect do you think it would have, particularly when it comes to preventative medicine in this area?
Well, Robbie, a couple of points here. One is that the investment in the early intervention and prevention is absolutely essential, so we obviously need to keep doing that and to be doing more of that. One of the big issues here, though, is that at the moment, the way in which the funding arrangements are set up is that at a state level, the state governments will tend to skew their resources to the hospital-based settings and are not doing significant investments in the community-based mental health services. Now, this is part of a bigger picture, and this is certainly something that SANE has been calling for, is that we need to get a really thorough analysis of the extent of expenditures that are taking place between the federal government and the state governments. Because what happens at the moment is we don't really know exactly how those mental health dollars are spent at a state level. And so SANE certainly has been calling for a productivity commission inquiry to look into this particular issue in the way that we sort of did around disability care.
So we don't know how much we could save or wouldn't save if we were to shift the funding into more preventative as opposed to crisis.
That's right, and I think that's one of the things that the Productivity Commission inquiry should look at. But the big thing here is that, according to the official federal government figures, we're spending about $6.8 billion on mental health each year. We don't really know how well that's spent or exactly where it goes once it goes to the state health departments.
Steve, one of the areas that has been highlighted by this survey of concern, and Jack mentioned it before, was the lack of crisis plans that patients are receiving after they've visited ER. What's your response to those concerns?
Look, I think the survey doesn't surprise me that a lot of people are reporting that they didn't receive crisis plans on leaving. We know that quite a lot of services are using crisis plans. They're using them in different sorts of ways. I mean, sometimes we've come across areas that have a policy of using crisis plans, but then we find that the consumers, the actual patients, are not aware that they even have a crisis plan when we come round to the next episode. So that's obviously a problem. There's been there's quite a lot of good work going around in small projects around Australia and in Victoria around getting crisis planning right, and particularly in the form of psychiatric advance directives. Now, you're probably familiar with the concept of advance directives for end-of-life care. We're starting to see more interest and more use of the Psychiatric Advance Directive, where someone can specify the sorts of things that they would like to see happen in times of a crisis for them when they may not be able to make those decisions for themselves. And they can be simple things like who would they like to be notified that something's happened, you know, someone to look after the pet, or they might be more things that are closely related to their health status. So certainly the use of crisis plans is something we need to get better at. And as I say, there are quite a few places around, at least in Victoria, where there are projects going on to improve the use of crisis planning. In fact, we recently saw an article published in the Lancet about a project done in the UK around joint crisis planning. And unfortunately, the way that article was reported, it actually sounds like the joint crisis plans weren't working very well, but in the context of the methodology they used and in the context of previous research, it does seem that there's quite a lot of promise in that process of joint crisis planning, where the index patient, if you like, the consumer, is in the lead in deciding what should be in their crisis plan. They're supported by their health professionals, their family, whoever else is involved in their care unit, if you like.
Jack, just on that note, can I come back to you for a moment? The crisis planning you've identified as not being as thorough as it could be, but even if it were improved, there is still always a problem, is there not, in regards to the patient not wanting to follow that crisis plan and often not divulging the contents of that plan with their carers or their families?
Yeah, I mean, often though, those situations where people are going into emergency, they're going in with their family members. They're not necessarily just going up there on their own. And obviously, in particular examples, that will be difficult. But this was one of the issues that was identified in the National Mental Health Commission's report card at the end of last year, where they're saying that you've got to make sure that these crisis plans are an integral part of the discharge process. And also, too, though, and this is something obviously that Pat could talk about, is the importance of involving the family or the carers in that process. And because we know we don't really invest enough in terms of the carers and the family members there, who we know are so important in terms of people's recovery. So there needs to be a great awareness of that and attention paid to involving the carers, the family members who are around.
Pat, can I just finish up with you, your response to what Jack's just said there?
Yeah, look, I definitely agree with that. And there's lots of reasons. I mean, service providers actually also, it's not just the person not wanting to talk to the family. Service providers will also marginalise families. And again, this sometimes comes back to the, you know, the families are often the people who take or ring the ambulance or the police or whatever to get. They're the ones who've instigated the hospitalisation for their relative. And there's often resentments there by the person with the mental illness. And so they then tell service providers, don't involve my family. So to me, that shouldn't be taken verbatim, because it could be that the family are integrally involved in the support of the person and they shouldn't be marginalised. They should be included. So there needs to be ways. There needs to, again, people are skilled in how to deal with that, how to talk to the person and say, no, you know, it's important that we involve your family for these reasons. And so we will include them where it's necessary to do so.
All right. Well, we might have to wrap up the discussion. But if you'd like to read a little more, of course, you can find the results of that survey via SANE Australia's website. And we'll also put a link to it on the Life Matters website. Thank you ever so much to my guests this morning. Jack Heath, the CEO of SANE Australia. Steve Elsom, the Director of the Centre for Psychiatric Nursing at the University of Melbourne. And Pat Sutton, Carers Australia Mental Health Carer Representative at the National Mental Health Consumer and Carer Forum and mother of two sons with schizophrenia. Thanks to all three of you this morning.
Thank you.
You're on Life Matters. Robbie Buck filling in for Natasha Mitchell for one final week. Stay with us. Coming up in just a moment, we'll be finding out if stress and fatigue can kill the male sex drive.